Our last speaker is attorney Jerome Pound. He is a solo lawyer with an office in Willimantic and serves as the general counsel for the Greater Northeastern Joint Board of the former Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union and its successor, the Union of Needle Trades, Industrial and Textile Employees. In Connecticut, he represents workers in labor and employment law matters and defends people accused in criminal matters. Mr. Pound is the treasurer of the National Lawyers Guild since 1999, has served as co-chair of the Guild's Labor and Employment Committee, and has been a Guild member for over 25 years.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here to speak with you. Of course, it's my daunting task now to follow such a panel of distinguished speakers that, one could ask, what is there left for me to say? After hearing the stories. But I did lean over to Raphael earlier when he told me he'd gotten arrested in Vieques, and I said to him, well, you're probably a terrorist. And the reason I said that was, and I think he's lucky he got arrested before the USA Patriot Act went into effect, because under Section 802, which you heard recited to you earlier, and the definition of domestic terrorism, what do you got to do to be a domestic terrorist? It sounds like you don't have to do much. You have to engage in some sort of criminal behavior, from what I take it. Any criminal behavior will do. You know, Raphael was probably trespassing on government land, so that probably qualifies as a criminal act. And he was probably doing it, my guess is, to influence the policy, or at least I'm sure he appeared to be looking like he was intending to influence the policy of our government. Well, that certainly fits the other prong of that definition. So I think under the definition of domestic terrorism, you're looking at a bona fide terrorist here. Congratulations. But it wouldn't be just Raphael. Do you remember the sit-in strikers who sat in at lunch counters in 15 states in the South to desegregate those Jim Crow states and dismantle the segregation that existed in this country? Remember those guys? Well, you know, they were trespassing. And, you know, by going in, I did leave out one of the other elements. Probably Raphael was guilty of this as well. But those sit-in demonstrators, they were certainly guilty of this, because one of the definitions that you have to be worried about here is that part of your action may endanger civilian lives. It doesn't say whose life. And it doesn't say who has to perpetrate the violence. So, you know, those sit-in demonstrators who might have gotten hit by the police with clubs and batons when they had to be removed from those premises, they were endangering, if nobody else, their own lives. They were breaking the law, trespassing, and they were probably doing it again, certainly appeared to be doing it with the intention of influencing a government policy. And I take it that would make them domestic terrorists under the USA Patriot Act. I don't know about you, but I'm scared, quite frankly. This is a terrifying set of events. Now, you've heard a lot of other things that people have said here about different experiences they've had, and you've heard some generalities about the law and some of the things that this act does. I'm going to try and become a little bit more specific and speak mostly about how this act affects activists. Before the enactment of this act, I might have stood up and asked you, how many here are engaged in social activism and are doing activist activity? Raise your hands, please, so I'd have an idea. No, don't do that tonight. No. I said before the act, I would have asked that question. I don't ask that question now. Because that's a dangerous thing to be engaging in, you know? Because under this act, you don't really have to be suspected of anything, you see, in order to be surveilled. If the government has a reason to believe, under Section 216, I'm just going to talk to you a little bit about Section 216 of the Act. It's a wonderful section of the Act. That authorizes surveillance of Internet usage. And what you have to do in order to get an order, if you're the government, to surveil somebody's Internet usage, is to establish that, to certify to a court, that you need the order to surveil the Internet usage because you are engaged in activity that, quote, is relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation, unquote. There's no limitation as to what kind of investigation you're talking about. I take it, once again, any criminal investigation will do. But, you know, if they want to surveil me, I don't have to be the suspect. I don't have to be the target. I don't have to be involved. All I have to be doing is being suspected of being involved in some activity that may be relevant. Might not be. But it may be relevant to their investigation. And then they can surveil the usage. Now, how do they do this? They can do it by placing taps and traps on your Internet use. Well, you say, well, you know, so what? They tap Pound's phone, you know, big deal. Much more insidious than that. The government has a new tool many of you may have heard of, maybe you haven't, but it's called Carnivore. Carnivore is a wonderful program that the government has come up with. It's a software program. What Carnivore does is it monitors and tracks Internet messages, email, usage of web pages, and can sort this stuff. Again, you might say, well, so they're going to do this to Pound's telephone. Oh, no, not so simple. Because Carnivore doesn't get installed on my telephone. It gets installed on the ISP, my Internet service provider. And Carnivore, good name for this thing, devours all of the information that passes through that ISP. Now, the FBI and federal government, you know, we should all feel secure because they have assured that they have filters that will ensure that no human eyes will see the content of any email or any web pages that they're not supposed to look at. And I don't know about you, but I certainly feel much more secure knowing that they have those filters. But that being said, nobody has actually verified that these filters work. So we don't know that what they claim they can filter, they can in fact filter. And I won't even bore you with the details about how it's very difficult to filter these things, because unlike a telephone conversation where, you know, dialing instructions go through the net, the telephone lines, and then after that you can tell when the conversation occurs. Because of the way digital information is transferred in packets, content gets mixed with address all the time. And there also becomes issues about, well, if they're checking what web pages I'm reading and they know what web pages I'm looking at, are they in fact getting to my content? There's certainly an argument about that, I would think. So it's a very difficult and dangerous situation that we're heading down on this road. And there really isn't a court check on this, because the court has to issue the order once the government agent certifies that, in fact, you know, this information may be relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation. That's all that's required. So there is no probable cause standard, and indeed, since I'm not a target, they're not going to arrest me necessarily, at least not, that's not the initial idea. I really am not entitled to any protection at that particular point in time. very dangerous kinds of invasions of privacy here, invasions of search and seizure, and perhaps not invasions, but certainly excuses to get around the search and seizure protections of the Fourth Amendment. For activists, and again, I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands, so please don't, but those of you who may be engaged in activity, you may use the internet, you may send email to some of your fellow activists, be forewarned, you may be doing things that may be relevant to a criminal investigation. So activists have to be very careful about how they proceed and what they do in this climate. And like Raphael, I'm very skeptical and dubious about the courts. I don't share the view that the courts are going to protect us and that they may find these things unconstitutional. One would have thought, perhaps, or hoped, at least, that the Supreme Court, if it had reviewed the internment of Japanese Americans by an executive order, would have said that, oh, no, this is unconstitutional. Well, they did review in 1944 those executive orders in a case called Karamatsu versus the United States, and in their wisdom decided that those internments were in fact okay, because it was not, the court was not going to try and second guess the executive branch at a time of quote unquote national emergency. So I have little faith that the courts in any kind of speedy fashion or even long-term fashion are likely to protect our democratic rights. And if anybody has any doubt about this and the way the court functions, I would encourage you to take a look at the court decision in, you know, the presidential selection case. Because if there was ever any case that makes it transparent about how our Supreme Court decides cases and whether or not they're politically motivated, I would submit to you, after reading that case, there can be no question that the court acts in a political fashion. And this court is not about protecting individual civil liberties and civil rights. So I don't think that the courts are going to be protecting us. And I don't think we can count on the federal agencies to stay within the law. They've demonstrated over and over and over again their disdain for doing that. And now everything, as near as I can tell, I haven't read all 342 pages of the Patriot Act, but, you know, I'm in good company because none of the senators, I don't think, have, and I'm reasonably certain none of the Congress people have either. So I shouldn't be an exception, I suppose. But that act contains most of the things and most of the abuses that were found to be illegal under the COINTELPRO operations that the government used illegally to stifle dissent during the civil rights and Vietnam era, simply because people were trying to exercise First Amendment rights. So I would encourage you not to trust the courts. I would encourage you, however, to stay on the streets. I would encourage you to talk to people. Talk to people who you wouldn't normally talk to about these things, because you might be surprised when they find out what's going on, how they'll react. We have to broaden and take this battle to the streets, to the people, so that the political will of the people can be preserved. I'll just close by reminding people that Senator Huey Long, back in the 1930s from Louisiana, said, and I paraphrase here, that if fascism ever comes to the United States, it will come wrapped in the American flag. So I would submit to you, now is indeed a time to be vigilant. Thank you.
You are listening to a panel discussion on civil liberties following the September 11th calamity. The event took place in Willimantic, Connecticut on March 21st, 2002. After the panelists concluded their presentations, the floor was open to questions from the audience.
Well, thank you so much, everyone, for speaking. And we're going to open it up now to question and answers. So we're setting up microphones right over here. If you do want to ask a question but you don't want to be recorded, there's little pads of paper outside on the table. You can write it down, and you can pass it to David Nelson, who's sneaking up behind me right now, or myself, and we will ask the question for you. So the question I wanted to ask was of Jerome Pound, and in a conversation previously, you had mentioned something that's happening in Utah, legislation that might create a crime called commercial terrorism, which is very interesting. And I just sort of wanted to ask you if you could just kind of explain that a little bit more.
Yes. I just learned of this last night when I was downloading email. Probably lots of other people in the government have learned about it as a result of that download now. The Judiciary Committee in the state of Utah, the legislature there, has reported out favorably on a bill that creates not domestic terrorism, as we know and love it under the USA Patriot Act, but a new brand of terrorism called commercial terrorism. And commercial terrorism is interesting because I'm trying to find the exact definition of it here, but commercial terrorism, as defined, I guess, in Utah, involves criminal activity by criminal elements, of course, but not for pecuniary benefit on their own part, but really criminal activity that in one way or another adversely affects or injures business interests, you see. It's a very important thing to protect, you know. And I take it, you know, that had Utah been thought of this 30 years ago, they really could have had quite a bit of impact on any of the desegregation boycotts and activity aimed at trying to persuade business people to desegregate their institutions. Yeah, here it is. I've now found it. Thank you very much. Here we go. Commercial terrorism, which would make it a felony to enter or remain unlawfully on the premises, that's basically trespass, right, or in a building of any business with the intent to interfere with the employees, watch out, labor unions, customers, personnel, or operations of the business. So, there you have it. That's commercial terrorism in the state of Utah. Now, I will say this bill, I don't know that the actual legislature has voted on this or even had hearings on it, but, you know, they don't really need to have hearings on it. Congress didn't with the Patriot Act.
If that is true, then what about universities and high schools and junior high schools being maybe infiltrated the curricula by the military? You know the answer. I heard that one of the radio advertisements for this meeting today was that the military was somehow in need of disclosing their financing and or infiltration into universities and schools somehow. Is that?
Well, I just want to answer real quickly. You have to remember in the definition of any of these, both on the Utah, the state proposal and the federal proposal, is a unit of government. And that goes down, all the way down to school boards.
Schools, yes.
Schools.
That's what I was wondering, because
yeah.
Is a school then a business that's being infiltrated by...
Well, the privatization of schools.
They would be committing a heresy under their own law.
Well, if I'd just quickly address that by saying that I've been in the National Lawyers Guild for a long time, and one of the things that distinguishes the National Lawyers Guild from many other organizations, particularly legal organizations, is that the Attorney General back during the McCarthy era, tried to blacklist us by naming us as legal arm of the CPUSA at that time. But thereafter, we were COINTELPRO'd. We found out in the 1970s when we sued the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And we were infiltrated for nothing more than, you know, protecting and advocating the protection of people's rights. Certainly many groups have been infiltrated. The history of the 60s and 70s is replete with instances of police agent provocateurs who actually brought about activity so that they could persecute and arrest people for engaging in the activity that the agent provocateurs encouraged them to engage in. So is it possible? Well, if you're asking me, I would certainly say it's not only possible, it's entirely likely.
I add something to that. There's an interesting section in the Patriotic Act that I call my attention. I think it's 507, and it has to do with schools, because what this section does, it allows the government to get an ex parte order to have access to the academic records of anyone who could be under suspicion of terrorism or in some way connected to that. But the interesting part, the really interesting part, is not that they can just go and get an order and you are not notified, but it's the fact that once they get your academic records, it becomes their property. And they can disseminate that to anyone, including the military, including the FBI, the CIA, whoever they want, because it lacks a... Once they access your academic records, there's no further judicial supervision. So the act itself has some well-designed mechanisms in which they can access information about you. You would not know about it, and then it could be spread around to the Navy, to the Air Force, to whoever, to the CIA, and so forth. So those are ways in which they are intruding into the academic and school fields.
Another thing that might be important to keep in mind is it may not directly point to address your point, but the Church Committee report and the Pike Committee report, I don't think ever came out, but the Church Committee report was released, and I'm talking about a Senator Church. This is late 70s, after Watergate, these committees investigated how these things happen and what's going on with FBI and CIA and all of those things. So the Church Committee report was released, and I forget the numbers and everything, but there were like hundreds of faculty members in universities all across the United States who were actually CIA employees or CIA paid people, and their job was actually to internally, not externally, not outside of the United States, but actually inside of the United States, to do propaganda for the CIA, write books and all of those kinds of activities. And this was a good 25 years ago that this report was released. So that's something else to keep in mind. This was the CIA, which really has no business trying to influence people within the United States. So something else to keep in mind.
And Secretary of State Ashcroft has gone so far as to ask that they loosen the restrictions and allow for the FBI, CIA, INS to go into locations such as churches, mosques, temples, etc., and monitor First Amendment activity. Much of what took place in the 1960s and 70s during the Civil Rights Movement is being asked that those laws that were put in place, those restrictions that were put in place, be removed during this time of national crisis.
I'm an organizer, not a questioner, and I just want to point out a couple of things. One thing we thought here, that getting you folks here tonight just to listen would not be enough. We'd like to see you all take some action, and we have a couple of little actions that you can take. We have one petition, which is just going to be delivered to our representatives. You have to read that, and we encourage you to sign it. The other sheet is signifying, if you want to, your willingness to join us at a meeting with our representative and or senators. We'll try to schedule at a time when you can go, like a Saturday. But if you put your name down there and your phone number, we will definitely call you when we set up a meeting with the rep. Thirdly, any of you who do these things or don't do these things, please write a letter to your congressman. You know, letters from a lot of people will get their attention. So please pay attention to all these things as we pass them around. Thank you.
I have a written question. Apparently, I'm told that in the 1970s there was a bill called Senate Bill 1, which seemed to be related to the Patriot Act and that it was very repressive. Does anyone know the relationship between the Patriot Act and Senate Bill 1 of the 1970s?
The only thing I can say is that, you know, each session of Congress starts renumbering their bills. So the 70s is an entire decade. There were probably more than one Senate Bill 1. And so I don't really know what it's referring to. But certainly the Patriot Act, as I think was pointed out earlier tonight, I mean, it doesn't really contain anything new. These are all old ideas that have been circulated, surfaced, used either legally or illegally with various effects over the years by the federal government and federal agencies. What's new about it is now that they've jammed it all together in one act and managed to get it passed with hurrahs from Congress in such record time and with so little review. But, you know, there's nothing in the act especially that is brand new and that those of us who have been engaged in social activism haven't seen before.
I have a second written question from the audience, which is, if the Patriot Act violates our constitutional rights, such as the Fourth Amendment and other amendments, and if we can't trust the Supreme Court to safeguard our civil liberties, who can we turn to do that?
Interestingly enough, now, it's organizations like the ACLU that have constantly gone to battle to protect the rights of individuals that are established in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. In this situation, and I think Azeem said it earlier, if the American people know, then they can call to action the political bodies around them. And I think that's a critical point, because what we can be doing right now, I know there's a moment of a call to action, we can call to have the USA Patriot Bill repealed. There's a sunset provision to the USA Patriot Bill, although it's incredibly weak, where Congress will have to go back and review this in 2005. But it is one of those situations where we need to become active, and we need to demand and hold accountable in the next election period individuals for the actions taken, because that is how we will. And if we cower down and let fear rule this situation that we're in currently, we will be totally disempowered and be taken advantage of. The government seizes the power that is given.
I may add to that my comment is tied to the last question. These laws or these rules that were passed with the Patriot Act and also with the amendment to the INS Code are not new. These are old. They had been called unconstitutionally previously by the United States Supreme Court. As Attorney Pond said, you know, we don't know what to expect with the Supreme Court, but again, we all have a duty to intervene in all of the branches of the government, and of course to speak to our representative, to go to the streets, and to also become knowledgeable as to what the Supreme Court is doing, as attorney also told you before.
If I may just add very quickly, you've heard that the 20th century was American century, and I think we have to really look very carefully about what's happening in the 21st century. And I think, as an American, I feel America is going to decline unless we as individuals interfere. And what do we have as powers? We don't have military power as individual. We don't have executive powers. But we do have the power of the pen. And that's mightier than the sword, in my view. Because if you tell people the truth, if you show the information to people, and you rally people That's what you've got to do. It's very, very essential that we do that, because we're really going down a road that's going to obliterate, in my view, and this is, I'm not being alarmist here, but I give you 5 years, and if it stays on this trend, American economic power is going to decline in the world, because what we are doing is essentially harmful to our own interests. We have been hijacked, literally, by a few individuals that are interested only in their own self-interests. And I can name you a few interests, including the military interests, the oil interests, a few people that are interested in supporting Israel, that I think to the detriment of U.S. interests across the globe. And this has been occurring for many years, but has come to a climax now, and it's going to make this country go down the drain unless we as individuals interfere and stop it.
Yeah, I want to echo that, because, you know, all of us, I think, who are sitting up here wouldn't be bothered to sit up here and talk to people, and I don't think you folks would be coming here if you weren't interested in communicating. And I think you need to be talking, because it really is the power of the people that's going to bring this around. But I do want to correct something that I don't want you to be led astray on. The USA Patriot Act does not sunset in 5 years in its entirety. There are provisions that continue to exist and do not have sunset provisions. For instance, the sneak and peek provisions that were referred to earlier are not, I repeat, are not scheduled to sunset at any time in the future. Similarly, Section 216, which I talked to you about, with this, which, you know, can be used in consort with carnivore, is not scheduled to sunset. So this isn't something that's just going to go away automatically if we don't do anything. And I will quote the words of not one of my favorite philosophers, but Edmund Burke, who said, all it takes, and I paraphrase again, for the forces of evil to overcome is for enough good people to do nothing.
I want to add something briefly about Section 213, which is a really important, and it's an example of how the Patriotic Act could have an effect on anyone. What that section does is actually it amends the federal criminal procedure to allow the government to go into your house secretly and do and seize an object and use it for evidentiary purposes against you without notifying you. Up to now, courts pretty much are even reluctant to allow the government to go inside your house secretly without any notification. But with this act, they can go into your house, they could pick up whatever, your computer or something, they can use it for evidentiary purposes and not notify you until the time that you are arrested. But the important thing is that it allows that to be done in any case of violation of federal law. Is not restricted to acts of terrorism. The government might be investigating you for IRS violation. The government might be investigating you for any violation of any federal or administrative rule. Would allow them to get a warrant. You're not a suspect of terrorism. You are, your car is full of stickers, United We Stand, and so forth. You really hate people who come to this kind of activities, but you don't pay taxes, and you do a little bit of a fraud here and there, and the government starts investigating you. Then this section, this section of the Patriotic Act, could be used to go into your house secretly, look around, pick up things, and not tell you until the time that you're arrested. So don't think that this law affects only terrorism or people who are suspects of terrorism. It affects anyone, specifically this section, which is really terrible, because what allows them is to actually, once they go to their house, to your house, and they get something, they might even leave something too, and they have a warrant. A judge is authorizing them to go there and get things. By the same token, they might also bring things. But the important thing is that it doesn't have to be connected to acts of terrorism. It could be any violation of any federal or administrative rule.
The first part of my question has already been kind of answered. I was going to ask for comments on situating this entire thing in an economic framework and what are the economic interests that are benefiting from all this increased repression? And that was just kind of answered. You just named a few names there. But I also wanted to ask, what we're seeing overseas now with U.S. military policy is the implementation of a lot of things that the Pentagon has been thinking about for a long time, things like they call it full-spectrum dominance, the idea of extending U.S. power everywhere. And they came up with these plans before September 11th, and they were couched originally in terms of the globalization of capital. You talked about the reaction that people had on September 11th. One of my first reactions was, this is the greatest thing to happen to the transnational corporations, because now they have a huge excuse for more repression. And just along those lines, mention was made earlier about Operation Northwoods. I wonder if you could just comment on that really quickly. Maybe a synopsis. Try to comment on the kind of mentality that is behind these, having in reserve almost these laws, and then when there's a crisis, to pull them out and to put them into place.
You mean Operation Northwoods as to what it was?
Just a quick synopsis. I believe that pertained to Cuba in the early 60s.
Yeah, okay. Let me actually read a little bit to you. And this is ABC News. Of course, it was not very much publicized, but it's coming from a mainstream source here. There was a book written by a journalist, and they were commenting on that. In the early 1960s, America's top military leaders reportedly drafted plans to kill innocent people and commit acts of terrorism in U.S. cities to create public support for a war against Cuba. Codenamed Operation Northwoods, the plans reportedly included the possible assassination of Cuban emigres, sinking boats of Cuban refugees on the high seas, hijacking planes, blowing up a U.S. ship, and even orchestrating violent terrorism in U.S. cities. The plans were developed as ways to trick the American public and the international community into supporting a war to oust Cuba's then-leader, Fidel Castro. America's top military brass even contemplated causing U.S. military casualties, writing, quote, "We could blow up a U.S. ship in Guantanamo Bay and blame Cuba, and casualty lists in U.S. newspapers would cause a helpful wave of national indignation," end quote. And this was a document signed by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and presented to the defense secretary, who was Robert McNamara at that time, who was Kennedy's defense secretary. Just a couple more lines here about it. The Joint Chiefs even proposed using the potential death of astronaut John Glenn during the first attempt to put an American into orbit as a false pretext for war with Cuba. And one last thing here. One idea was to create a war between Cuba and another Latin American country so that the United States could intervene. Another was to pay someone in the Castro government to attack U.S. forces at the Guantanamo Naval Base, an act which Bamford, that's the name of the journalist, notes, would have amounted to treason. And another was to fly low-level U-2 flights over Cuba with the intention of having one shot down as a pretext for a war. And again, this is the way the world works, so we should not be too surprised. We should be aware of how, you know, things work, really.
You were listening to a panel discussion on civil liberties following the September 11th calamity. The event took place in Willimantic, Connecticut on March 21st, 2002. After the panelists concluded their presentations, the floor was open to questions from the audience.
I feel both energized and distressed by this talk. The panel has been wonderful, but I feel unable to act. When it comes to people who have disappeared, I hear figures 1,100, 2,000, more than 2,000. I believe them. Every one of those people has a name, an address, a family who knows who they are. I want to know the names, the addresses, the conditions of residents of Connecticut who've been held in this way and are being held. I can't act on a figure. I can only act when I know the name of the person I'm acting for. I think in Connecticut we do have state officials who would interest themselves in violations of existing law that are happening on Patriot Act. But we need to have the specifics from the families and friends of those people who have disappeared.
I want to make a comment about that. I think that the same sense of hopelessness, the same sense of a lack of a ability to act that you feel, even attorneys feel them. A lot of people are feeling that way. There are a number of organizations like the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, the American Civil Liberty Union, and a number of groups that are attempting to do something regarding this issue. The problem is that when you're dealing with immigrants, the federal government pretty much has absolute control over that. I wanted also to mention something that I see on a daily basis in my work in Hartford, and that is connected with that. It's not people that are being seized and kept secretly, but the impact that all this new culture, all this new situation of that I call a new legal regime, is having on illegal immigrants. I deal with many cases, particularly of women who are victims of domestic violence. I can tell you, from September 11 now, the abuses that you see, especially of men who are citizens and who married women from other countries, and that they bring them here, they get them in a catalog or something, and you know, and they have this supposed situation where they were going to become also citizens, and then they engage in acts of domestic violence and abuse and so forth. And I see many of them who are in a situation where they fear. They don't even want to talk about it. They don't want to even go to a shelter. They don't want to even bring it up because they're afraid of the consequences of the fact that they are immigrants, the illegal immigrants, or they don't have the papers yet. I had a phone call the other day of a woman crying that called me because her brother, who has been here for many years and who is a worker and who was driving the car, he was stopped for not stopping at a red light. He was arrested because he was an illegal immigrant. What I think is important, a way of dealing with this, is what I mentioned at the beginning, we have to start a dialogue between the people who are concerned about domestic violence, the people who are concerned about workers' rights, the people who are concerned about the environment. We have to turn off the TV once in a while and not watch headline news because we're not learning anything, and start talking among us as to how we're going to deal with this, because a lot of people are suffering directly because of the consequences of this new law, and it's going to have an impact widespread. So we need to promote a dialogue like we have to here tonight. We have to do it in other places, and we have to open ourselves to new ideas. We have to listen to minorities. We have to look in the history of this country of how in the past people have dealt with situations of terrorism, abuse, and police brutality. I think that's the beginning. Unfortunately, just thinking in terms of legal actions is really limited what we actually can do at this time.
Yes, I suppose I'd add to that just briefly. If you think that lawyers are going to do something, we're not. Lawyers, and I say that coming from a background of doing social activism, and I wanted to become a lawyer because I naively thought 30 years ago, that the law could be used as an instrument of social change. I don't really believe that anymore. There was a little blip in time when that was true in this country, but basically the law protects the status quo and is not likely to help us out. And we need to talk to each other. We need to have this dialogue. You need to talk to your friends who aren't here. You need to read. You need to get your friends to talk to their friends and bring people together. We've got to talk about this, and we've got to get people talking to one another. We're not the enemy here. We're the, you know, the solution to this problem. But if we all go home and act scared, they're going to get the better of us.
You asked about the individuals that have been arrested and any information about those individuals so that we can help them. The ADC, American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, for example, collects information on people who have been arrested, asks people to submit information when things happen to them. The problem with this issue is that this is only going to get a glimpse of what is really happening. The ACLU and the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee and over 20 other organizations have submitted a request to the government based on the Freedom of Information Act to try and get even basic demographics of the number of people that the government is holding in terms of their races, their backgrounds, their ages. this information the government is not willing to share, is not cooperating with this. I don't think we can do it in individual at a time because it will be losing the forest for the trees. We really have to address the root cause, and we have to look at this as a total package, and that's how we do it, is exactly as you said, is by going out and by talking to journalists to start to get those guys who are an influence in journalism, the Hartford Courant. Why isn't the Hartford Courant doing stories about that? Let's get five of us and go meet with the editorial board of the Hartford Courant. I met with them about 3 months ago, and they don't hear from us enough. They don't get people from here to go meet with them and tell them, go investigate this. This is important.
I think the one thing that we have to remember here is that the government has power as long as we give it to them, and they will deny information to the general person, and they are passing laws even here in Connecticut that restrain how much information that you can ask from the government. And the FOI requests that were denied by the FBI are happening time and time and time again, and legislation is getting passed and passed and passed. And I think it's good to be energized, and it's good to be frustrated. I don't think there's not a person who hasn't done something that's not completely frustrated and a little bit afraid about what's going to happen. But I think, you know, we always said don't talk politics, religion, and finances at work. Talk politics, religion, finances, and the USA Patriot Bill and other legislative action. Because if we don't start talking about it, if we don't start filling these rooms with overflow capacity, is not going to be seen as a priority. In this state, it takes 5 to 10 phone calls for you to impact the statewide legislature. It takes 5 or 6 emails to our own state congressional leadership to make something happen. And I'm a proponent of write letters to your editorial boards, send emails to your legislative leadership because they're still afraid of anthrax and they may not open their mail. But if you send an email or you send something via fax, it's going to get there. And you have to do it. It's almost like it takes one to know one. You have to do it. You have to find somebody else that's willing to do it. And you need to put your money where your mouth is. You need to identify those organizations that you want to support that are fighting the battles that you want them to support, to fight for you, and then go out there and assist them in getting that work done. Freedom is not free.
It's so frustrating to get information about the names of these aliens who are detained that even their own attorneys are having difficulty getting access to the evidence against them and to the places where they're being detained, because frequently these people are taken out of the state and nobody knows where they are.
Actually, for those who would like to get some information, a good place to start would be Amnesty International's most recent report. It just came out a week ago. Go to their site, whatever it is. I actually have a copy of their press release right here and a copy of the full 45-page report. So that's a place to begin in terms of getting the information. But beyond that, I think the point we are making is right, that don't just focus on one individual, but try to understand the full situation and sort of try to address that situation. A couple things to keep in mind. As the panelists just pointed out, there was one case where a detainee's lawyer, it took a month for a detainee's lawyer just to figure out where that person was. It took a month. And also, it has not been advertised. Mr. Ashcroft's memo, I read about it to his department. This is the Justice Department, to resist all attempts at Freedom of Information Act request about the Freedom of Information Act. So that's the kind of situation to keep in mind. But again, for information, you could just begin at the Amnesty International press release and the report and go from there. Right, Amnesty International USA.
AmnestyUSA.org.
Okay, AmnestyUSA.org. Actually, also www.amnesty.org might also have the same thing, because that's where I have this copy from.
While we're giving out email addresses, you can also check out the National Lawyers Guild website. It has a lot of information and links to other organizations and sites of interest. That website is a real easy one to remember. It's www.nlg.org.
Okay, my question is to the attorneys here. If an attorney is unable to get information out from a government agency like the Department of Justice for what the Department of Justice does not answer in any kind of a case, does the state congressional representative have a right to request the government agency and get that information out? Are they the ones that who can really contact the let's say Department of Justice and get the information out from them? Maybe a senator or a congressman, do they have a right to do that? Or even they are beyond that?
Well, the Freedom of Information, in November 7th, when the Freedom of Information request was made by this assortment of organizations and from specific attorneys, it was denied by the FBI to those organizations as well as to the senators who were requesting the information. A piece of that comes from an executive order that was issued after the USA Patriot Bill passed about what information would and could be released and whether they were going to tell Congress, inform Congress fully on all of the information. There was a period of time where they stopped, they weren't going to communicate with Congress, the administration, and they withheld this information. So senators can't get this information.
All right. So even if you approach somebody like Senator Lieberman here, he may not be able to get what you want.
Okay.
Well, but that's not a good reason not to ask them, okay? Because this government and your representatives are going to respond to voters, your constituents, okay? And if enough people call a congressperson and say, I want this information and I want you to get it, they're going to start asking more questions if they feel that there's a constituency out there that's going to back them up come election time. Because if they're not getting reelected, if people are disappointed in what they're doing, they're not going to get reelected. So if there's a constituency out there that's demanding that they do something for whatever it is, in this case, getting names, they're going to be more forceful about pressing this. And just as they enacted the USA Patriot Act, they can bring other acts to curb these abuses. But they're not going to do it so long as, you know, they see all the American flags flying around, and that's what they think, that the American people are going to let them do everything that they just want to do in ignorance.
Yeah, there's just one example of how far this has gone. I'll just read four or five lines here from a case in Ann Arbor, Michigan. The court proceedings in his case have been so secret that even the defendant has been barred from attending. He has had to watch them on video from his jail cell without the right of participation. And his visa irregularity is so minor that most immigration experts agree it would, under any circumstances, be settled by an exchange of letters and the payment of a modest fine. And here's the thing. John Conyers is a leading, ranking Democrat. He sits on the House Judiciary Committee. And this thing says, Conyers, and I read Conyers' statement also about 3 or 4 months ago. Conyers, the senior Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, was himself barred entry into the courtroom during one of Haddad's recent hearings. He and several dozen supporters were forced to sit out on the pavement outside the courthouse.
If we're finished with that question, I just wanted to end with a note of hope. I have a copy here of the full statement that was made by the widow of Daniel Pearl, the journalist that was killed in Pakistan, and that actually was not presented that way by the media. The way headline news put it was they took the sections that they wanted and they portrayed what they wanted to do. And I wanted to read it because it goes back to what I said at the beginning. We have to look at the people who have suffered to see if they can if they have reacted with a sense of violence or there's a hope that we can look for other solutions to the problems that we're facing. So I wanted to read it, and it's going to take a minute, and I thought it would be interesting to finish with this. It says like this: revenge will be easy, but it is far more valuable, in my opinion, to address the problem of terrorism with enough honesty to question our own responsibility as nations and as individuals for the rise of terrorism. My own courage arises from two facts. One is that throughout this ordeal, I have been surrounded by people of amazing value. This helps me trust that humanism ultimately will prevail. My other hope now, and she was pregnant in my 7th month of pregnancy, is that I will be able to tell our son that his father carried the flag to end terrorism, raising an unprecedented demand among people from all countries, not for revenge, but for the values we all share: love, compassion, friendship, and citizenship, far transcending the so-called clash of civilizations. The fact that this woman, after the death of her husband, could say something like that, I think it's a hope that there are people out there who can respond to the current crisis that we have with a hope of peace and mutual respect among people, and not simply going to kill more people. Thank you.
I also want to throw in another little note of hope, and that is that a lot more people are getting concerned about this issue. And I just heard yesterday that the city of Denver passed a resolution declaring the city a sanctuary for civil rights. And unfortunately, it's not legally binding, but it's something where the citizens of that city got together and said, you know, we need to at least have a voice about this. So there is growing dissent around this.
So concludes this series on liberty and security after the September 11th calamity. This program was produced by George King at the studios of WHUS Radio at the University of Connecticut. Sound engineering was by John Schwenk. The music used in this program was composed by Dominic Muldowney. Thanks for listening.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
We'll always be filled by unwelcome travelers and other brave men. They'll take your money.
This is a test of the wireless mic. Gonna find out how bad this hum is. Not sure what causes it, but we'll see. Okay, this is a test with the wireless mic. Right now I'm standing by the chair. I'm gonna walk and talk away from the chair. I'm now at the end of the desk, heading out to the landing, in the doorway, and out onto the landing. Now I'm over at the top of the staircase. We're going to see how this affects the hum from this thing. I don't imagine I'll be much further than this in the recording situation tomorrow. Okay, now I'm walking back. I'm walking, I'm talking. I'm walking, I'm talking. I'm walking, I'm talking. Walking and talking, leaning over and turning this off. Okay, this is a test. I'm going to be walking and talking, walking and talking. Going away with the transmitter, same old deal, standing here at the top of the thing, coming along into the hallway. Now I'm by the top of the stairs, standing by the top of the stairs, walking and talking. I'm going to see how much bass hiss and static there is and whatnot. There was quite a lot in the previous one. Well, which was a supposed good lavalier that seems to require much more poop. Okay, so here we go back, walking and talking. Walking and talking, coming back towards the transmitter and turning it off.